Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 8,000 food items from Europe, South America, the Middle East, and the Orient. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When we think of small towns, one of the things that may come to mind is safety. But small communities are not immune to violence, nor are their schools. Today we take a look at rampage school shootings. Our guest is a social scientist from Harvard University, Catherine Newman. She is one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. The book grew out of the desire of Congress to understand what had happened in Kentucky, Arkansas, and Colorado. The U.S. Department of Education was asked to research why these tragedies had occurred and what might be done to prevent such horrific acts of violence. The National Academy of Sciences was called in, and the Academy sought out social science researchers, including our guest, Catherine Newman. Newman and four of her doctoral students went to work. Two of the students moved to Heath, Kentucky, where on December 1, 1997, in West Paducah, a high school freshman shot into a prayer circle before classes were to begin at Heath High School. Michael Carneal killed three of his fellow students. The other two researchers moved to Westside, Arkansas, where two boys, Andrew Golden and Mitchell Johnson, aged 11 and 13, killed four students and a teacher at Westside Middle School on the afternoon of March 24, 1998. Together, the five researchers would interview 163 people in the communities affected by the shootings. What they learned is contained within the pages of the book, Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Royalties from the book are being donated to the Heath and Westside schools. In addition to Catherine Newman, Sybil Fox, David Harding, Jal Mehta, and Wendy Roth are the book's authors. Catherine Newman is with us this afternoon to share some of what she and her fellow researchers learned about violence in schools. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, the toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Catherine Newman. She is a professor of urban studies at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is also dean of social science at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The book Rampage is published by Basic Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Newman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When your students moved to Arkansas and Kentucky, it had been about 3 years since the shootings. Where were those communities in terms of healing from the shootings?
I don't think these communities will ever really heal from the shootings. They were certainly still traumatized at the point that we arrived. Of course, some people who lost very little were able to move on fairly soon thereafter. All the communities shared the shock and sorrow, but for those whose children didn't die or weren't wounded, after a year or so, the shock began to fade. For the families who lost their children, I don't think this will ever end. And so for most people in the community, they're stranded somewhere between those two poles. But the shock, the hurt, the sorrow, the sense that something had gone terribly awry was very palpable even 3 years later when we arrived.
Yeah. What happened to the families of the boys who killed their classmates?
Well, in Paducah, Kentucky, the family of Michael Carneal stayed put. They were very well respected before the shooting. They continued to be embraced and loved by the community thereafter. That would not be true of the families who lost their children, but most other people thought of the Carneals as respected, grounded, real members of the community. They had been there for three generations, and the families were not going to kick them out at this point, even though there was tremendous anger about what had happened. In West Side, the story was a little bit more complicated. The Golden family, whose son, 11-year-old Andrew, had been the youngest of the shooters, left town, moved to the outskirts to a more remote area, and bought a home that wasn't so easily accessed from the town. But they still work in the jobs that they held before. Mitchell Johnson's family didn't have the resources to go anywhere. And I would say that they are still also fairly well respected and loved in the community, although opinion is rather divided on the quality of parenting in all three cases. The sense that the town needed to close ranks around its wounded members extended even to the families of the shooters by all except those who really lost their children. And for them, it was just too hard to accept the parents of the shooters as upstanding members of the community. I don't think they'll ever get over that.
Yeah. Now, Michael Carneal, you report, was the product of a happy, stable, comfortable home, a church-going boy of above-average intelligence with no serious disciplinary record and no known history of psychiatric problems. But apparently there were warning signs.
There were. It's true that Michael came from a stable, happy family. His father is a lawyer. His mother is a very well-educated homemaker. Their home was the kind of place other kids gravitated to when they weren't so happy in their own homes. They frequently had other kids over for dinner, took children who were friends of their own children off on vacation. So the Carneal family was very well respected and central. But there were tensions inside the family, as there are in many American families. Michael's older sister, Kelly, was a very successful student. She was the valedictorian of the class that graduated the year of the shooting. She was a standout musician, singer, newspaper journalist in her high school. She really was one of the stars. Michael, 4 years younger, was not very socially successful. He was not well liked. He was thought of as something of a goof off. He was not a major disciplinary problem, but he wasn't a social star either. The marching band is a very important social activity in Heath High School, and there are 60 some odd kids who participate. In the year that Michael was a freshman, 62 kids signed up, and he was one of two that was asked to stand down because there weren't enough uniforms, which sounds like a trivial matter, but it was just one of many incidents that symbolized for Michael a sense of social failure, and in sharp contrast to his older sister, with whom he shared teachers and now a common school, he wasn't doing very well. And he was trying awfully hard to become a member, an accepted member of various social groups, and generally failing in all of those contexts. That doesn't mean he was friendless. He certainly wasn't a loner, but he was what you might call a failed joiner. And so there were warning signs along the way that all was not well with Michael. Many of these warning signs, though, were very hard to interpret at the time. For example, he had trouble sleeping. He wouldn't sleep in his own room. He frequently would sleep in the living room. And the family didn't seem to think anything of it, but it turned out that Michael was terrified of sleeping in his own room because he thought there were vipers and snakes and monsters in his room. In much the way that a young child will be worried about bears in the closet, Michael was worried that there were demons everywhere, and he didn't outgrow those fears. In fact, they were amplified as he got older. He was hearing terrible sounds, threatening sounds in his head, but no one around him was the wiser of this. He did have a series of disciplinary incidents in eighth grade and in the early months of his high school class, but nothing very spectacular. Enough, however, that if there had been a purview looking backwards, a record that spanned those two schools, it might have been easier to see that he was in trouble. For example, although he's very bright and his test scores place him in the top 10% of his cohort, his grades plummeted to 1.8 GPA in the eighth grade. That should have been a warning sign to someone. Just before the shooting, in the weeks before the shooting, his handwriting just began to disintegrate and run together in unintelligible streams. He submitted essays to his high school teachers, especially in his English class, that were truly murderous in their tone, and asked permission to use the real names of his high school classmates in those stories. When you put this all together, of course, with the advantage of hindsight, there were lots of reasons to be worried about Michael, and even more pronounced reasons among his peers who heard him utter threats increasing in frequency as the shooting drew nearer, that he was going to shoot people, that he would be bringing guns to school and that something terrible was going to happen on Monday morning.
Hmm. Mitchell Johnson and Andrew Golden, were there warning signs there as well?
There were, but again, it was difficult for people to interpret what they meant. For example, Andrew Golden was something of a zero in school, which is not to say that he was a bad kid. He just didn't have any particular reputation, didn't impress on his teachers any particular personality. He was sort of absent as a presence, if you get my drift. He certainly wasn't a discipline problem in school. He was known as kind of a jokester, a sort of sunny kid, but not particularly high profile. However, in the neighborhood, Andrew was known as a menace. He rode his bike around town with a knife strapped to his leg, and he threatened other kids with it. Kids were aware that he had been abusing animals in the backyard, that he'd been shoving kittens through a storm fence and shooting them with BB guns. But the school wasn't aware of this behavior, and neither were his parents, as far as we're able to determine. The kids in the neighborhood were very aware of this, and they were afraid of him. And so their parents were aware of their fears and would tell them to stay away from Andrew. So in the neighborhood, there were warning signs that all was not well with Andrew Golden. The only warning in school, though, was that he told one boy either that he was going to kill himself or that he was going to kill other people. There are disputes in town about what he actually said. So there was that one incident that led people to think, the people who knew about it, that something was troubling Andrew. But it didn't go very far, and this was an incident lost in the haze of the past until the shooting itself. In Mitchell Johnson's case, we have a more complicated family story. Mitchell was the son of a woman named Gretchen who had divorced his father, who had been her second husband. It was a stormy divorce, and Mitchell was caught in between in a torrent of verbal abuse from his father, who constantly threatened to take him away from his mother. The family moved around a fair bit, but actually his last residence in the small community outside of Jonesboro, where his mother had remarried, was by far the happiest he had ever known. So immediately prior to the shooting, Mitchell, by outward purposes, looked like he was in very good shape. But inward, he was troubled. He was troubled by his father's belligerence. And a few weeks before the shooting, a series of incidents happened that pushed him into a sense of real depression and despair. He began making sex talk phone calls on his father's credit card, and this was discovered. And his father threatened to come and take him away from his mother. He was cut from a sports team for carving a message into his arm with a knife. His girlfriend dropped him. And this series of events, we later realized, or he explained to his mother, made him feel as though he was sinking into a dark pit of despair. But these were not things that were immediately evident to anyone else, because on the surface, Mitchell appeared always to be extremely polite, very respectful. Only a month or two before the shooting, one of his teachers, unsolicited, sent a card to Mitchell's mother, which she showed me, that said, "Dear Mrs. Woodard, I just want you to know what a wonderful child Mitchell is. He's so polite. You must be incredibly proud of him." So the signals around Mitchell were extremely mixed and difficult to interpret.
Yeah. And we have a lot of things coming together all at once, right?
And I think that for all three shooters, the idea of shooting up the school began as a desire to reverse their social reputations, to shore up the kind of weakness they felt in their peer networks, to show people they were really dangerous, notorious men instead of weak or socially unacceptable boys. And the more they began to threaten to shoot people or threaten to do something dangerous, the more these public pronouncements almost trapped them into having to go through with it. I'm fairly sure that they were ambivalent. We have some research resources that tell us they were ambivalent about what they were going to do. But in order to attract attention to reverse that social reputation, they made public commitments about what they were going to do. And that essentially boxed them in to doing the shooting, because if they back down, it would be one more truly catastrophic social failure from their point of view.
Yeah, I was really struck by something that Michael Carneal said to investigators apparently after the shooting how he was feeling prior to the shooting. When he got hold of the guns, he said, "I was feeling proud, strong, good, and more respected. I had accomplished something. I'm not the kind of kid who accomplishes anything."
Yes, it's a very sad commentary.
Yeah. And that's one of the conditions, shall we call it a condition, that is underlying a rampage shooting.
Underlying rampage shootings, we find this kind of social fragility, this despair about fitting in or having friends, this feeling that you're socially unacceptable in every group, and that you have to do something dramatic to change the way people perceive you to become more socially acceptable to your peers. And sadly, that's really what the shooters are trying to accomplish. They have a problem. They have a method by which they're trying to solve that problem. They're not thinking about killing people. They're not thinking in terms of revenge, especially. They're really thinking about, how do I get people to like me and respect me? And this sounds, of course, bizarre from the viewpoint of those reading the book, but that's really what they were trying to accomplish. And once they set themselves on such a pathway, it becomes almost irreversible, because they have made these wild claims and gotten people to pay attention to them because of those claims, and they find they can't back down.
What role does media, the idea that we live in a culture of violence, play here?
I think it plays an important role, but not the one that most people expect. I think the general view of the media is that somehow it inspires a kind of murderous rage and almost desensitizes people to violence. It's not that that's not true, but it's not the major role that the media plays in these cases. The main thing that media images do is lay out a script for these boys about how you achieve a sense of notoriety and a dangerous aura as a masculine man. It's really a positive image from their point of view of what they would like to be remembered for. And so it lays out the means by which you achieve this reputation. And that's really the inspiration they're taking from the media, rather than imitative violence per se.
Yeah, I was struck by something that Michael's sister Kelly said. She was a witness to the shootings at Heath High, and she saw her brother with the gun, and she thought he didn't know who she was. That he might shoot her. This goes to the point that there is a desensitization there, and it's unreality.
Well, I think we must realize that in Michael's case, as is true, I suspect, for many of the shooters, what was really going on there was a dissociative breakdown. He was entering a new stage of psychosis, which was not recognized, not diagnosed, and certainly not treated. And it's commonly the case in a dissociative break that people do take on a different physical appearance. They do look larger. They do look almost unrecognizable. And they certainly are not in the same reality as their audience is. And so it's quite possible that Michael didn't even recognize his sister, but she barely recognized him because of the change in his physical posture. So it's not that that he was somehow imagining a different reality. He was undergoing a psychotic breakdown, and today he's on very heavy antipsychotic medications. But at the time, no one understood that Michael was hearing voices in his head, that he was beginning to lose his grip on reality as a psychotic will, because it's very difficult for us to recognize psychosis in 14-year-olds.
Mm. And in the case of Andrew Golden and Mitchell Johnson, was there an underlying issue of mental illness?
It's harder for us to know, because as juveniles, their records are sealed. And so the closest I was able to get to their psychiatric records was to interview other people who had seen them, because despite extensive efforts, I wasn't able to see them myself, whereas in Michael's case, I was able to read the psychiatric reports myself. People who have read the psychiatric reports, especially on Andrew, say that he is definitely described as someone with serious sociopathic tendencies, someone who was very deeply troubled. But again, at 11 years old, we have a very difficult time recognizing the symptoms of what in an adult might be classified as a sociopath.
Yeah. Now, in the case of Andrew Golden, you know, often we think of bullying as an issue, and here we have a bully, right?
I'm afraid the research shows us that bullying and being bullied go hand in hand for an awful lot of kids. They tend to be a similar syndrome. And it is also often the case, especially for kids with the kinds of mental disorders I was describing in Michael's case, that they overinterpret or are hypersensitive to bullying, which is not to say everybody doesn't hate bullying, because anyone who's bullied will learn to despise the experience. But kids often come to realize that this is the turf they inhabit as adolescents. It's not something they enjoy. They don't look back on adolescence with any great glee as a consequence of it, but that it sort of comes with the territory. And they all say, almost to a person, that none of these three shooters experienced bullying that was any more intense than what the average kid experienced. But it certainly meant more to them. It was interpreted as a greater slight, as a more damaging commentary on their social place than most kids would have interpreted the same experience. So the general view was they gave as good as they got. And this is why kids didn't see them as unnecessarily singled out.
Yeah. What could we do to better recognize this situation? What could be done to address these feelings of rage or prevent the buildup of rage altogether in adolescence?
Well, it would certainly help if adolescents were kinder to one another, but I think it's unrealistic based on the research that we've done and the fact that most of us in the adult population can remember these experiences ourselves. It seems to be a locked-in feature of adolescence. Some schools do better than others. Some recognize bullying as a serious social problem, and they treat it. They treat the whole school for it. One thing that I do think is very important is that adults shouldn't tolerate it when it happens in their presence. They should not give tacit consent to it by ignoring the problem, as they often do. They often ignore it because they think this is a problem teenagers need to learn to solve on their own. So they have a positive reason, in a sense, for this pattern of ignorance. They think this is a proving ground, and adolescents have to learn to grow up and solve their own problems. But especially for these kids, they're not capable of solving this problem on their own. And when they see adults turn a blind eye, the conclusion they draw is adults are not responsive to adolescent problems. It's a delicate balance, because we do need to let kids grow up. They do need to learn how to solve their own problems and fight their own battles. But recognizing that it happens and sanctioning it when it occurs in adult presence, I think, is extremely important. In Columbine, it was the common experience for the two shooters there to be slammed into lockers by the larger athletic boys in full view of coaches who didn't do anything to stop it. Adults who don't do anything to stop this behavior are tacitly giving their consent to it. And I think one of the things we found in this book is that it's more than an adolescent problem. The culture that surrounds the school, in which adults are playing a role in reinforcing adolescent hierarchies, contributes to the feelings that shooters have that there's no exit for them, that they are going to be stigmatized everywhere they go, not just in adolescent society, but among the adults who are participating in the same high school football evenings on Fridays and recognizing the hierarchy of pretty girls and athletic boys, so that there really will be no release for them as they get older. In small towns, that feeling is exceptionally pronounced because there isn't another set of social niches easily available to them as there might be in big cities. So we all participate in reinforcing the social hierarchies that make these boys feel on the edge of rage.
Yeah, and then you can see everything looks like it's out of control, right?
They come to feel as though they really have no options, that this life they're experiencing, which is distressing and painful to them, is never going to end. It's never going to change for the better. Now, in small town, it did surprise me to learn that school shootings tend to take place in small towns, because we think of serious violence of this kind as the kind of thing that happens in big cities. But it turns out rampage school shootings never happen in big cities. And when we ask ourselves, why would that be the case, The answer comes back that in small towns, this feeling of no exit, this feeling that your problems now will be your problems 10 years from now, 20 years from now, is very pronounced, especially in highly stable small towns, because you don't see people leaving. In the year that Michael was a freshman at Heath High School, the year his sister Kelly graduated, only 3 people left the town and went away to school. So the dominant experience is staying put. You're going to the same school your grandparents went to. And that intergenerational stability is precisely what makes many people feel like small town America is exactly where they want to live. That kind of closeness and intergenerational solidarity attracts people to small towns. And it's great for people who are doing well socially. But for the marginal kid, for the troubled kid, it's like a life sentence.
Hmm. What's the lesson there for what we're doing with kids outside of the classroom, let's say in extracurricular activities, to show them, try and show them that there is a larger world, and you can come home or you can stay here, but there is a larger world that's worth investigating?
I think this is exceptionally difficult for small towns because they are a long way from anywhere, and it is costly for them to expose their children to the wider world just because it takes longer to get to a big city. But I do think it's worth it. We see that this is an exceptionally pronounced problem in middle school. There are big differences between middle school and high school. In most American middle schools, the only activities available to kids will be football and cheerleading and all those clubs that are going to come later in high school that will allow kids perhaps to find niches that are more to their liking, the drama club, the debate club, the chess team. You don't see that in middle school, and the problems of these shooters began in a very pronounced way in middle school, where there's really just a single pecking order. Once they get into high school, there's a bit more differentiation. Even that will reach its limits, though, in a small town which doesn't have enough kids to have lots and lots of clubs and activities, and which tends to be perhaps more insulated from the more cosmopolitan trends in larger cities. I do think it's worth every effort, though, to make it clear to kids that there are different ways of being an effective man or a respected woman. You don't have to be absolutely rail thin and beautiful, which is what drives many young girls into inward forms of self-destruction, like bulimia and anorexia. And you don't have to be a macho boy loaded with muscles in order to be a successful man, which is what many young boys in high school come to feel, that if they're not built like Arnold Schwarzenegger, that they'll never have a social life. It's ironic because when they look around the town, they can see lots of examples of successful men who don't look like Arnold Schwarzenegger at all. Michael Carneal's father was a lawyer. He was very well respected, but he was hardly a bodybuilder. So even in his own immediate environment, there were examples of men who didn't fit that athletic mode, who had happy, successful, stable, respected lives. But the popular culture image that adolescents are exposed to is driving them toward these forms of conformity and perfection that are often unreachable and exceedingly hard for adolescents in small towns. So anything we can do to expose them to the wider world, to let them know that there are other role models out there, perhaps to celebrate the achievements of nerdy boys. We don't see gigantic pep rallies for the debate team. We see gigantic pep rallies for the football team. In Columbine High School, the trophies that greet the visitor in the foyer are these huge football trophies. There's nothing there to celebrate the achievements of the chemistry club, if there even is a chemistry club. So we send signals as adults about what we respect, and kids are sending their own signals about what's respectable, and it doesn't include very much diversity of models.
Catherine Newman is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a professor of urban studies at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also dean of social science at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She's one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. The other authors are Cybele Fox, David Harding, John Maeda, and Wendy Roth. And royalties from this book are being donated to the Heath and West Side schools. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us today with your questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi. We have a listener there on line one. Okay, well, maybe they will call back. I don't know what the problem is there. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we've got another call coming in. So rather than my launching into another question, let me reintroduce our guest again, Catherine Newman, our guest. Author, one of the authors of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. The book is published by Basic Books. Let's try again. Line one, listener in Champaign. Hi.
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Go ahead. I'm sorry. It's our fault. It's our fault.
Okay. My question is, how come this sort of crisis doesn't happen to minority kids? I'm sure that they have some of the same problems, or maybe they don't. I don't know. I didn't go to school here in the United States, so I'm curious to know. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
That's an excellent question. And I think the reason that it doesn't happen to minority kids has to do with the geography of school shootings. They tend to happen, as I mentioned before, in small towns, in rural areas, and to some degree in suburbs, but about 65% of them occur in small towns in rural areas, and we don't tend to have large minority populations in the United States in communities like that. So it's the community geography, I think, that is at stake here. I want to emphasize, though, that violence, of course, is a very serious problem for minority kids, especially in big cities. It's just not this kind of violence, not this kind of rampage shooting with its anonymous targets that's aimed at the school as a social institution. We do see plenty of revenge killings, of drug conflicts that go bad, that may even result in homicides that spill onto the school campus. But the kind of shooting I'm describing tends not to happen in big cities, and big cities tends to be where our minority populations live.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line two in Urbana. Hi.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
We had a little problem there. I think I came in about 10 minutes late, but into the program. But I think something was mentioned about depression, and one of the things that really has been troubling me is that this increase of children, certainly now they're putting them on medication and all that kind of stuff. How much of a factor was this, or I guess the overall question is, why is it increasing, among children?
That is an excellent question. I didn't set out to answer that question, but I would like to say that depression plays a very important role in these cases. The saddest thing is that it tends to be undiagnosed depression. After the fact, we learn that a very high proportion of school shooters exhibit the classic characteristics of clinical depression. But the fact is it tends to be missed in them. And that is partly because we have a difficult time assessing the mental health of adolescents, especially young adolescents, in general. We don't put a lot of resources into it, and we don't have medical models that are as easily or watertight forms of diagnosis as we might see for adults. But the caller is absolutely correct that adolescent depression is rising. It is a serious issue. It's hard to know if it's rising because we're getting better at recognizing it or because the phenomenon itself is growing. But whichever of those two things happens to be the case, we certainly have a serious problem on our hands. This is one of the reasons why I think that if we put more resources into mental health screening and treatment for adolescents, we would have somewhat more success in catching these school shooters before they become as extreme as they are. And I think it's one of the reasons that justifies such a financial outlay for many communities that will never see a school shooting. School shootings are thankfully extremely rare, but adolescent depression is not rare. It's growing, and we need to address the problem. And if we do, the resources we utilize to address it will also help to deal with this problem of school shooting.
Well, there's also the, again, I guess I would rather see therapy, one-on-one therapy for such things rather than going to the medication. It gives them to talk out these problems and some discovery. An issue that concerns me is even for very young children, anxiety, medication for anxiety. But anyway, I'll let you comment on that and I'll hang up.
Well, I think your point is, again, well taken. We have seen some recent reports of rather distressing medical evidence that medications that have been prescribed for children have very deleterious effects, medications being prescribed for depression. Ironically, in the case of the school shooters, because in general they are not diagnosed, they're not being treated, they are not generally on these medications. That's not to say it doesn't happen sometimes. It does. There have been some spectacular shootings in which these medications played a role. But for the most part, tragically, these are kids who are not being seen by doctors, not diagnosed, and not being treated for depression at all. So the drugs aren't playing nearly as much a role as we might think. That said, of course, there is a lot of concern about over-medication. We are now prescribing Ritalin in ever-increasing proportions for young children, especially young boys who have problems paying attention in school, or what we now call attention deficit disorder. I have no doubt that some of those kids genuinely need help, but I suspect we are medicalizing a fairly common condition of boys who don't like to sit still. Mm. And it may be that we are expecting too much concentration, too much mastery, the emphasis that we have on early acquisition of skills may cut across the developmental biology, especially of young boys. This is not an area in which I am an expert, but I do know that problems of overprescription of drugs like Ritalin, for example, are legion.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Naperville on the toll-free line. Line 4, hi.
Hi, I got more of a comment than actually a question. I'm originally from Europe, and I got a degree in psychology and pedagogy. And the reason why I refuse to take tests and work in my field is that actually what's going on here is the system is too much involved, and the actually system take away parenting from the parents. And I think that's the heart of the problem, because kid cannot have privacy in my house until he's 18 and responsible for his actions. I mean, that's all I have to say. I take my answer off the air if you have any comments. Thank you.
Well, let me address the problem this way. It's typically thought, I think, by many Americans who read about these terribly frightening tragedies, that they're explainable by lack of involvement by parents in their children's lives, that somehow we're all too busy. Sometimes they talk about dual income families where nobody's at home and they're not paying attention. We found exactly the opposite in these school shooting cases. These were communities that were extremely involved in the lives of their young people, where parents were devoting unbelievable numbers of hours to traveling with their children in these band competitions and attending football games and socializing in large intergenerational family groups, participating in sports on the sidelines, cheering their kids on. It simply wasn't the case that parents were not involved. In fact, I would say if I compared West Paducah and the communities outside Jonesboro with the town that I live in here near Boston, these parents were far more engaged in the lives of their children than is typically the case in my very well-heeled suburb. So I don't think it's the case that in these towns that the schools have somehow superseded parents in their involvement with their children. Ironically, it was the very involvement of those parents that often made the school shooters feel as though they really had no out, no venue in which they could develop a positive social reputation, because if they were despised by their peers, they were also despised by their peers' parents. These interlocking social relations were so tight that there was no social sphere in which they were successful. It just spread too quickly. The social networks that connected parents and children, the church leader who was also the bus driver, who was also your next-door neighbor, who was also your teacher, that was a very common kind of social arrangement in these towns because they're so small and so stable. So this was surprising to me, because going into this project, I thought we were going to see evidence of distant relations between parents who didn't know what their kids were involved in, and that's how they got their hands on weapons, and that's how they got involved in terrible plots to shoot the school, with the parents being none the wiser. Instead, what we found was the parents were so aware of what their kids were doing and so on top of them that it was driving deviant behavior deep underground, where it was even harder to see because the kids knew they were under surveillance. And this, in turn, catalyzed in the parents almost a false sense that they knew everything that was going on. They certainly knew a lot, but they didn't know what was driven deep, deep underground, because the kids were desperately trying to find some sort of privacy away from parents, and they weren't very successful at it.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just heard your speaker talking about the necessity to expose students to other worlds that expand their immediate reality of this small town, so self-contained and with no avenues for them, offering no avenues for the students, and just the narrowness of the glorification of sports. And one way I see that could be a possibility, I don't know what is her comment about teaching of a foreign language that expands their viewing of the world and exposure to new cultures and new sensitivities of other people, perhaps make them more aware of how other cultures live and studying overseas, and perhaps encouraging that it would be something good in high school, the teaching of enforcing the teaching of foreign languages like German and Spanish and French and Italian and so on. And I just wanted to comment on that, and I think it's very important, the mingling of to other cultures and expressing more themselves. So I just hung up and listened about this, my comment. Thank you.
I think anything that we can do to expose kids to other cultures, other ways of living, either outside our society or even inside it, will be beneficial to them. And that could take the form of other languages and cultures. It could take the form of the arts. It could take the form of, breaking down cars and rebuilding them. It can take a million different forms. The point is to show them that there is more than one socially approved way of growing up, and if you don't do well out on the football field, it doesn't mean your life is over, and if you're not the prom queen, it doesn't mean that there's no future for you and no one will ever love you. These are very extreme ways of looking at the world, and for adults it seems sort of almost amusing that kids are so myopic, but in fact in that adolescent world these strictures take on incredibly powerful meaning, and they can lead to forms of depression and isolation that are extremely damaging. And we do need to take it seriously because that's the world they live in. We need to enter their world and try to show them that there are exit routes to other social experiences that in time they will appreciate, even if it's not possible to do that much while they're in high school. There was a wonderful segment of Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's wonderful film, in which he was interviewing the author of South Park, the comic strip that's so popular among teens. And he was, Matt Stone, who writes that script, was a student at Columbine High School himself. And he talked about how deadeningly conformist it was and how miserable he was. And he says at one point, "If only those shooters had known that high school is just a short part of your life, and that when you leave it, the kids who do poorly in high school socially are going to be successful out in the real world, and the kids who are the football stars will not be." That is a reality which was clearly not evident to the shooters in Columbine. It wasn't evident to Matt Stone himself when he was at Columbine High School. So anything we can do to show kids that life goes on after high school and is often quite different than the high school experience will, I think, help them to see there's a future beyond the present.
Well, thank God it's not forever. I was so relieved when I got out of high school myself.
I think many of us were.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line two. It'll have to be very quick. Urbana, go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious about the outlet that you just gave in response to the earlier comment. I'm curious if you would put the internet on that list as a means of exposing teens to a broader worldview, or on balance, is it more negative and socially isolating and things like that? I mean, more and more that is a social scene for youngsters and adults. and certainly would expose them to peer groups that perhaps they didn't have in their smaller communities, but at the same time, you can see where they might get into a group that might just sort of reinforce their psychopathology. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the Internet and its potential role, some of the events that have happened in these small communities. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll have to keep it brief, Professor Newman.
Let me just say that that's an excellent question, and I don't think we've done enough research into it. I can tell you Michael Carneal had a very active Internet life, and it was pretty scary stuff. That said, I suspect for many kids it does act as exactly the kind of window on the rest of the world that I've been advocating. So like most other forms of media, it's a mixed bag with positive and negative contributions to this problem, but it's something we need to study much more than we do. Young people today live in an electronic universe that is somewhat opaque to the rest of us.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine Newman has been our guest. Look for the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. It's published by Basic Books. Royalties from the books are being donated to the Heath and Westside schools. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. The Bears were indeed out in force today. Here are the specifics. May wheat, a high on the day of 418, a low of 406.5, settling at 407.5, down 7 on the day. July, a high of 424.5, a low of 414, settling at 416.5, down 7.5. September, a high of 427.5, a low of 420, settling 420.5, down 7.25. December wheat, a high of 435, a low of 427, settling 429.75, down 6. March, a high of 436, a low of 431, settling 433, down 7 on the day. May corn had a high of 326.5, a low of 321.5, settling 322.25, down 8.25. July, a high of 330, a low of 329, settling 329.5, down 8.25. September, a high of 332, a low of 328, settling 328.25, down 9. December, a high of 331, a low of 326.25, settling 326.5, down 10. March, a high of 333, a low of 328, settling 328.25, down 10.75. May, a high of 334, a low of 331, settling 331, down 10.5. July, high of 336.75, a low of 331, settling 331, down 10.5. December, 05 corn, a high of 285.5, a low of 282.5, settling 282.5, down 4.5 on the day. May oats, a high of 173.5, a low of 170, settling 172, down 4. July, a high of 178, a low of 175, settling 176.25, down 4.5 on the day. In the soybean pit, the May contract had a high of 989.5, a low of 965, settling 967. The technical correction continuing, down 21 on the day. July, a high of 986, a low of 965, settling 967 and down 22. August, a high of 942.5, a low of 918, settling 920.5, down 30.5 on the day. September, a high of 833, a low of 816, settling 816.5, down by that low at 25.5 on the downside. November soybeans, a high of 768, a low of 750, settling 752, down 26.5. January, a high of 768, a low of 754, settling 754, settling on the low at 25 down on the day. March beans, a high of 760, a low of 748, settling 750, down 24. May soybean meal, a high of 317, a low of 309, settling at 309.50, down 7.30. The July high on the day at 315, the low 307.50, settling 308.20, down 6.60. May soybean oil, a high of 31.50, a low of 31.11, settling 31.22, down 66. The July oil contract, a high of 31.40, the low 31 even, settling 31.14, down 64 on the day. The settlement prices are also in from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and it was an exact opposite day of all the downside that we were seeing on the board, wasn't it, Celeste?
Yeah, a bullish day today on the Merc. Livestock prices higher, except for May pork bellies. April feeder cattle, 92.60, the high, 91.70, the low, 92.42.5, the settlement, that up 120. May, 90.25, the high, 88.25, the low, 90.05, the settlement, that up 265. August, 91, even, the high, 88.95, the low, 90.95, the settlement, that up 255. April live cattle, 84.40, the high, 82.65, the low, 84.22.5, the settlement, that up 230. June, 79.50, the high, 77.05, the low, the settlement, 78.95, that up 227.5. August, 77.90, the high, 76 even, the low, 77.85, the settlement, that up 195. October live cattle, 78.80, the high, 77.45, the low, finishing at 78.77.5, up 150. April lean hog, 64.47.5, the high, 63.80, the low, the settlement, 64.32.5, that up 125. May lean hog, 69.40, the high, 68.50, the low, 68.90, the settlement, that up 70. June, 76.47.5, the high, 75.35, the low, 75.82.5, the settlement, that up 67.5. July lean hogs, 74.60, the high, the low, 73.75, the settlement, 74.25, that up 47.5. And May bellies, 107.80, the high, 105.80, the low, 106, even, the settlement, that down 125. The Dow is up 66 points at 10,508. The NASDAQ is up 9 at 2062. The S&P 500, 5 higher at 1144.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Persephone and Flora, A Celebration of Spring, featuring the paintings of Jenny Chi and floral art by Rick Orr. Verde Gallery features a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor in downtown Champaign. Be inspired.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Cully Dean from Haines, Alaska writes, "Dear Dr. Science, the esteemed scientist Dr. Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard recently asserted that we live in the age of bacteria. Is he right?"
He's speaking about his own reality. Perhaps Dr. Gould has a problem with personal hygiene, and maybe his assertion is really a cry for help. Academics and research scientists are notorious when it comes to bathing. Many only chance it when their colleagues or students file a formal protest. I remember a biology professor I knew who was essentially a walking petri dish. He didn't need agar-agar. He simply colonized a multifloral bacterial wonderland on his own body. The space beneath each fingernail held a microbial treasure trove.